Learn from today's most innovative brands and observe how they empower employees, engage consumers, design products, and co-create experiences together. Welcome to the Brand Lab series from AE Marketing Group.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Walker. We're excited to have you with us. This is a new episode of the Brand Lab series podcast, broadcasting each week from 1871 here in Chicago, where we explore today's most innovative brands alongside today's most insightful executives and entrepreneurs. Today's guest is Steve Pemberton. Steve is the Global Chief Diversity Officer at Walgreens Boots Alliance. He's also an accomplished author and is about to release a film documentary about his life story. And with that said, let's enter the Brand Lab. Hi, Natalie. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm super excited to have Steve on today. I've been trying to get him on the show for a while. He's very busy. We happen to both sit on the board of UCAN together, and that's where I've gotten to know him over the last couple of years. And I know we've talked a bit about UCAN, both on the show and off the show. But he just has such an interesting life story and such a big job at a global brand that I'm thrilled he could join us today.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear some inside knowledge about Walgreens for sure, but also UCAN. We talked about UCAN, especially on episodes 3 and 4 with Tom Vandenberg. That was super eye-opening. This interview should prove to be just as eye-opening and inspiring.
It certainly will be, as someone who has had the opportunity to get to know Steve. So Steve, welcome on the show this morning.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start by telling our audience just a little bit about yourself and your role at Walgreens?
Sure. I'm the Global Chief Diversity Officer for the Walgreens Boots Alliance. I actually arrived at Walgreens in 2011 after a similar role at the careers website monster.com. And then in 2014, my role expanded as Walgreens merged with Boots Alliance from Europe. So my role went from being the chief diversity officer for a then 110-year-old, very, very successful domestic company to now a first ever global health and wellness enterprise that's really in its infancy. So quite exciting times.
Very much so. And I was thinking about this topic of diversity because it's come up once or twice on the show in the last 2 years. When I think about the industry that I'm in, marketing, it's struggled a lot with diversity, obviously, first through gender, through race, even diversity of ideas. So when you're talking about now this giant global organization that you're a part of, what does diversity look like at Walgreens?
If you look at the trajectory of diversity and where it's been anchored, and rightfully so, in corrective action, righting a wrong, whether that's discrimination, sexism, racism, and rightfully so. We know our long history there. But I will also tell you that in the business world, changing demographics is really the denominator and the driver for diversity and inclusion. So many companies have found themselves suddenly serving a very diverse customer base because our demographic landscape has changed so dramatically. If you look at America, you know, this morning, and the morning is early, and by the end of the day, we'll have a number of children who will enter the world for the first time. And one of two of those children will be of color. And this is going to continue on for the next 40, 50 years. So you have a demographic base that's really shifting, changing the way in which we interact and engage accordingly. So that means in our world, certainly, that if we are not attentive to that changing customer base, then we're going to struggle to be competitive and relevant to these emerging customers. And then it's not just that diversity is changing so dramatically, it's where it's changing. Historically, when you talk about diversity in America, you're thinking about the coasts in some way, shape, or form, or the cities, and that has some historical relevance to it because that's from the early stages of diversity, but that's not this current and ongoing wave. You know, communities, cities like Salt Lake City, Utah, are roughly 10% Latino. Des Moines, Iowa, Lincoln, Nebraska, seeing similar kinds of trajectories. So in the world of Walgreens, that means that the store managers and our pharmacists are seeing their customer bases change and different kinds of interactions accordingly. And lastly, it's why I think diversity is going to be far more sustainable than it's been in the past. There's a reason for these false starts that you're referencing and our inability, both in the business world and beyond, actually to truly wrestle and grapple with all the powerful implications that could possibly mean.
Walgreens is a catalyst brand. It seems to be everywhere. Talk about how the company maintains that culture of diversity at such a massive scale.
A few things. It all goes back to that word, my. You talk to an individual, and when the topic of Walgreens comes up, they always say, my Walgreens. And they're referring to the one in their neighborhood, but they're also very likely referring to the one that they went to as a child, or that their grandparents even went to. One of those very few long-standing generational brands. A bit of our secret has always been in our people, actually, and to understand the local dynamics and nature of how our communities think and act and operate. So on the one hand, you have this common life event that's health and wellness. Doesn't matter who you are, where you are, we're all engaged in the pursuit of health and wellness for ourselves, for our families, for our communities, for our country. But that takes on different forms in different communities. When our team members are coming from those communities, they often reflect, you know, the attitudes, the cultures of those communities, but it all stays under, you know, the Walgreens brand. So you're not trying to impose this ivory tower mothership view of diversity. You're understanding that while diversity is a global discussion and or a national phenomena, it's really operationalized locally. And to understand that, first and foremost, is the pathway, I think, and the key to maintaining it on such a large scale.
And just kind of building on that, can you talk about how this culture that you are building and refining and scaling a diversity actually improves the customer experience on the back end?
There are two factors going on. One, it's no secret that retail is under enormous pressure, largely because of e-commerce. So it takes us a lot of effort to get you to the store, and we have to be absolutely certain that the experience that you have in that store is pleasant, is reflective of you, your community, and your needs, and therefore will lead you to come back. That does require looking at this through the lens of the customer. And I'm thinking about something that we did most recently in our San Francisco market, where we partnered with Hallmark to deliver greeting cards that reflected the number of Asian celebrations, Chinese New Year, Diwali, that reflected that specific customer base. And what a certain kind of, you know, local phenomena has unfolded, because now we have customers coming from all across San Francisco, but they're coming to this specific store for those cards in particular. And yet, if we took a snapshot of the customers who walked into those stores, you know, at first glance, you'd think that these would all be customers of Asian descent, but they're not, because we all have friends from different cultures and backgrounds and experiences, and we want to recognize their own culture, their own celebration, and it gives us much more empowering, inspiring kind of message around diversity when it's operationalized and looked at through the customers. They're always our best guides. They tell us what they're looking for, why they're looking for it, and most importantly, how we can continue to refine our products and services to meet those ongoing needs.
Steve, so over the last 2 years, we've had a number of global brands on, from IBM to Aon to Deloitte. Can you also talk a little bit about, from your perspective, because I think it's very unique, this integration with Boots Alliance and bringing together, which you alluded to towards the beginning, a very iconic American brand with a European brand. And did you encounter any bumps along the way in terms of being able to roll out this same diversity, experience, and inclusion throughout the global scale?
One of the biggest challenges that companies, global or multinationals, often run into with diversity is that they try to impose a U.S. view of diversity and inclusion on the global market. And it never works because it means different things in different places. So while Walgreens, Boots, and Lions came together, well, we all had learning. If you get a thing in any merger and integration, you're going to. We were highly cognizant of the importance of understanding, right down to the exact countries in which Walgreens Boots Alliance operates, that we're highly attentive to those countries, that we're, on the one hand, consistent in our execution around innovation, partnership, dedication, trust, care, but we also have to localize those efforts. So we didn't have as many learning curves as most multinationals do. Having said that, the biggest challenge is the anticipatory change specifically. So whether you're dealing with issues of gender equity as it relates to compensation in England, which is an ongoing issue and an emerging one that's long been the standard here in the United States, to anticipate that and to be prepared both for obviously the experience that our customers have, but also for our team members internally is a way to avoid a lot of those false starts.
So we talked about corporate branding with Walgreens located all over the world. But now we want to switch gears a little bit and talk about your own personal brand. We understand you faced a lot of adversity growing up, and we were wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
My approach to diversity, summarized by the idea of the iceberg, that which is above the waterline is much smaller than that which is below. In many ways, that's a lot like us as individuals. There are things that we see when we see someone. We see their age. We see their height. We see their ethnicity. We see their gender by and large, whether or not they have a disability, physical disability. Those are things that you see when you see someone. But the things that you can't see that are below the waterline, that are not as evident, is applicable to all of us. So while I have this wonderful role of Global Chief Diversity Officer for Walgreens Boots Alliance, below the waterline is a much different story of a child growing up in foster care, taken from his mother at 3 years old, a father nowhere present. And then I subsequently got lost in the gaps of the foster care system. And there are many wonderful, outstanding foster families all across America. I encounter them in some way, shape, or form every day. But there are also those, and there are far fewer of them, but there are nevertheless those who are, not to be impolite, but are exploiting the system. And that's where I found myself, regrettably so, for my entire childhood. And the intersection, actually, of diversity in my own personal story happened quite a few times. Probably the first was when a social worker told me that the reason that they could not find me a permanent placement was because they couldn't figure out whether or not I should be in a white home or a black home. And that really confused me, because at that age, 5 years old or so, about the only thing that I had experienced in the way of color was a box of crayons. So I thought that they were referring to the color of the house. I had no idea what they were talking about. And as the years went on and the inability to find a safe, secure home unfolded, it still came down to that basic conversation, actually. And that was something quite instructive for me. Make sure that you spend more time trying to figure out who someone is, what their life journey has been, what their experiences are, rather than what they are. And that was all, I think, crystallized for me around the second narrative that unfolded. I had, in essence, been in the particularly cruel clutches of one family for well over a decade. And every day was a battle. to eat, to be safe, to learn, to try and find someone, anyone who would see you as more than this broken boy had been frequently depicted by the foster family. They were shrewd and manipulative, and because they were paid for taking care of me in their world, it was necessary to keep money coming in, and that meant hiding the real truth. And so I just fought them. You know, that was my reaction to it. I fought. And my way of fighting, particularly when you're a young boy, was I read every single day. And that gave me a certain kind of armor to deal with their constant salvos, and ultimately resulted in me escaping after 13 years, just a couple of days after Christmas when I was 16 years old.
Steve, we appreciate your vulnerability on this topic. And what's really interesting, as I said earlier, is that I had known you for a few years, but actually not known some of the backstory. You then went on to write a phenomenal best-selling book, A Chance in the World. But then you took it even a step further and you started a foundation. So why was creating that nonprofit important for you?
Well, to do anything else would have been to retreat. You know, I have managed to have my victories. I'm a husband and father of three. And so in many ways, I've managed to navigate that and come out on the other side. I'd like to think, you know, whole and intact. But when you write a book that shares some of those tough years in the pathway to adulthood, one of the things I just could not anticipate as I was writing it was the number of stories that others would pour into me, and they do every day. And I think that would be true for any of us. If we get a life story down, invariably, you will be writing the chapter of somebody else's life who will find strength and sustenance and direction from yours. But I also wanted to do something to help, guide, assist, because for as long as I breathe air, I'm never going to forget what it was like to try and get my chance. And that's all I wanted, was just a chance. And I wanted the duality of the responsibility of a chance. I need a chance, but I have to do something with the chance when it comes to me. And the number of people I continue to meet who are asking for exactly that in the smallest of ways, a kind word, a gesture, an introduction, career advice, they're all looking for a chance. A Chance in the World, the foundation, based off the title of the book, was intended to do just that. And that takes on many different forms, whether I'm supporting UCAN in Chicago for children who are the most vulnerable in our society, who have suffered trauma and inherited tragedies, and can they get a chance? Or that's Bernie's Book Bank, focus on childhood literacy, or delivering scholarships to a middle school in the community of New Bedford, Massachusetts, where I grew up. It's all around this, it's all around the central need for us all to have a chance and then the opportunity to do something with that chance. The story for me was never going to be complete until I was doing something with this improbable life story that's unfolded, which many times still surprises me.
Wow. Well, thank you. Yes, that's wonderful that you've taken your experience and been able to bless so many others. That's truly impressive. Beyond the book and the foundation, you're debuting a feature film documentary based on your life story this week. So tell us a little bit about the decision and the process to make that film.
Well, Natalie, almost immediately after the book was published, I started hearing from movie producers who said, this is absolutely a movie. I was wondering how exactly they were going to distill a near 100-year story down into a couple of hours. But so I found myself on a lot of trips to Los Angeles and meeting with certainly, you know, interested and well-intentioned, you know, producers. But in so many of those meetings, Natalie, they gave me this look that I come to recognize as a boy. And that look always said, so who are you and what are you doing here? So I recognized that look. And I realized that I had a vision for how I wanted this to unfold that would be empowering and inspiring and impactful and deliver a central message of accountability and responsibility. And sometimes it was the way I'd say it, if it was meant for them to see, then they would have seen it. But in many cases, they didn't. And so what we decided to do here was go the independent route. Very good friend of mine in Chicago, businessman Mike Bousas. Our sons played basketball together. And long story short, he approaches me after a tournament, and a basketball tournament. He says, you know, I keep hearing about this amazing life story of yours. What's that about? And I had known him for a couple of years. And so he said, well, I'm going on a trip here. Do you have a book? I said, no, I have something better since you're driving. I gave him the audio version because I narrated the audio book. And he calls me at 1 o'clock that following morning and says, I'm sitting in my driveway and I'd like to go inside, but I can't because I can't walk away from this until it's done. And he was the one who actually introduced me to an independent movie producer, Tom Bastunas of Mighty Small Pictures. And then Tom hired a great director in Mark Avedic, and they assembled an outstanding cast. Tom Sizemore, Lawrence Hilton Jacobs, Nick DeToro, Cinda Williams, Fred Williamson, and this amazing, amazing child actor. He is now 13 years old, Terrell Ransom Jr., who plays me. To watch that all unfold, to see parts of your life depicted in that way, it's a bit like time travel. You know, you're kind of literally going back in time because you're looking at movie sets that have been created exactly in the way that you described them. But there are also some central messages of fight and fortitude and faith, forgiveness, family. So I'm really looking forward to this sneak preview, which we are also doing as a fundraiser for my foundation, A Chance in the World, as well as another foundation, Love Without Boundaries, which is focused on international orphans and adoption. So it promises to be quite a spectacular evening.
Well, I am privileged to have seen a little bit of a teaser of the film, and it just blew me away. And I know you started to talk for just a minute about this, but I'm curious, as someone who just described a very challenging upbringing in a very intimate way, and then to write about it, and then to build a foundation about it, and now this film. So what is it like then when you sit down, whether it's just you or maybe you and your family, what is it like to sit down though and then actually watch this film on the big screen of your life?
When I find the vocabulary to express that, I'll let you know. It's really humbling. That's probably my first reaction. I don't mean that, you know, that false humility that suggests while polite, you know, suggest that I'm better than you. It is more of that awe that in a way something is happening through you and not necessarily for you. And that perhaps the reason you endured that all was to help those who are also trying to come through something and fight through something. And that is the real hope and intention of the film, much like the book was. I want the film to be that too. And I'm saying that because of the stories that I get every single day and from all over the world, none of which I could, you know, I could ever predict would come my way. And they just astound you. Just yesterday, I have a biological brother who I didn't meet until I was 24 years old. We all went off into foster care. And yesterday on social media, a home where he was raised, another adopted child in a home wrote to me because he had read the book. And I was writing about his adopted brother, and who is my biological brother. I want you to imagine something like that happening every day in some way, not quite as intense as that, but something like that every day. You know, a 73-year-old man from Ireland who wrote to me to say, thank you for writing this because I lost a great deal as a child as well. And I've never been able to put it down. But now that I've read your book, I can go to my rest in peace. Oh, you know, you have to pause for a moment when you get something so powerful like that. To have given that gift, I guess, of peace to a man who's no doubt lived a wonderful life but has carried a burden, who I will very likely never meet, that's humbling. And yet in these particularly dissonant times where it feels to me that cynicism and hopelessness is all around us, and I really do think that our pathway through this is for us to be reminded of the innate resilience that a lot of us have, of the commonality through adversity that many of us have, to look to our deeper human experiences and connection. And though someone may be of a different gender, look completely different than you and of a different faith, that you can find a thread of your life in theirs, and they can do the same in yours. That's the pathway through this.
Great. Thank you. Steve, how can our audience learn more about you and A Chance in the World?
Several ways. I am on all of the social media at @iSteve Pemberton. So you can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter under those handles. You can also go to a website for the foundation, achanceintheworld.org. And so your audience can reach out to me there. We are having the sneak preview of the film. It's free on June 6th, the Pickwick Theater in Park Ridge, Illinois. We're going to have members of the cast there. Promise to be a magical evening. And folks, reach out to me on social media, and we can extend to them, you know, an invitation accordingly. And because I have teenagers, it is equally important that I be on Instagram, or so they say. So I'm on Instagram as well.
I don't mean to laugh. This has been such a serious conversation, but I'm glad that we're ending on a little bit of an upbeat tick there. As we joked earlier, Natalie and I are parents of younger kids, so we have a lot to look forward to, I guess, when they enter their teenage years. But I know this was a slightly different conversation than we would typically have on the Brand Labs series. But I think it's an important one. So we obviously started talking about the role of diversity through the corporate lens, but as well as looking at diversity and adversity through the personal side as well. And Steve, it's been a really great opportunity to get to know you through our work together at UCAN and in other places over the last couple of years, and to learn more about your story. I'm super excited to see the full film on June 6th at the premiere. Looking forward to that. So as we kind of come full circle and wrap up today's show, what's next for you?
That's a great question. In an ideal world, unlimited hours in the day, I would write a second book. That would feel to me to be next. And it's has far less to do with my own story, but I really want to tell the story of so many other people's lives and unravel this concept of resilience in the everyday hero. It is based on the everyday person who wakes up and they are dedicated to their communities and their causes, their cities and their country. And I think that their story is getting lost in our relentless pursuit of celebrity. That would be ideally my next book. I'm very hopeful that the film, currently an independent film, that it will find its way to the major festivals, and that a distributor will find and will see the same power and impact that we do. So those are the things on the immediate horizon. But I've also learned that man plans and God laughs. So there could be other narratives that will emerge too.
Well, Steve Pemberton, you are an inspiration to me personally, as well as I know many, many others. We're very grateful for you to spend some time with us this morning on the Brand Lab series. We encourage all of our audience to visit chanceintheworld.org, learn more about Steve, his book, his film, and it's just been a real pleasure hearing you tell your story both at the corporate and personal level today. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Brian. You're right. I've encountered wonderful people along the way, those who that for whom you're instantly connected to. You share a certain kind of simpatico, even if you can't fully define it. And you're one of those. So I truly, truly appreciate that. And Natalie, thank you as well for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to meet you.
And the same.
I want to thank our listeners for joining us in the Brand Lab today and to invite you back next Tuesday as we continue our journey of today's most innovative brands, as we learn how they empower employees, engage consumers, design products, and co-create experiences together. To listen to other Brand Lab Series podcast episodes, visit brandlabseries.com. Follow us on Twitter at Brand Lab Series. And if you have any questions or ideas for a future Brand Lab Series podcast, email us at info@brandlabseries.com.
To learn more about Walgreens, visit walgreens.com. To learn more about A Chance in the World, please visit achanceintheworld.org. And you can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Steve Pemberton. And you can also find me on LinkedIn as Steve Pemberton.